This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Our guest this episode is Adam Spink, an air traffic controller at London Heathrow Airport, who also acts as deputy manager of the ATC team for the Riyadh Air Show. In the news, FAA issues an airworthiness directive that paves the way for the Boeing 737 MAX to return to service. Also, Delta and tariffs on Airbus aircraft, Gatwick slot usage and planned labor action at Heathrow, speed dating in the air, Norwegian air shuttle troubles, autonomous airplane tugs, and an F/A-18C Hornet goes to the National Air and Space Museum. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 629 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hey, everybody. Early happy Thanksgiving. I guess this will be released on Wednesday, so if you're in the States, happy Thanksgiving. Hopefully you're staying safe and looking forward to a kind of an across-the-pond segment. I'm looking forward to our guest and talking about that mysterious stuff that we call air traffic control. We don't really know what they do except run around the tower all day long.
Although I have seen a sweatshirt that kind of explains what ATC is all about. Maybe we'll touch on that in a minute. But first, let me introduce Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's also a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Hey, good evening. How are you doing, Max? Great to see you. And I'm wondering, did you receive that little gift I sent to you?
I did. I got a nice, what is it, a 1 pound or 1.5 pound bag of nuts, bag of first-class nuts to replace the first bag of first-class nuts that I have consumed already.
Well, this time I ordered a bag for myself, so we've been enjoying them as well, too. Yeah, if the airlines aren't buying them, they're available cheap, so enjoy.
Yeah, I will.
Just what this show needed, more nuts.
Exactly.
Yeah. Of course, that leads to the obvious transition, which I won't use, which would have been, speaking of nuts, let me introduce our guest. But I won't say that.
No, Rob's not on the show tonight.
Yeah, don't say that. Yeah.
Instead, I'll say our guest this episode is Adam Spink. Adam has been an air traffic controller at the Heathrow Airport Tower for 22 years, although when you see his face, you'd never guess that he was old enough. Well, maybe sans the hair. But he's also an instructor. This is a crazy show, I guess. He's an instructor, he's an examiner, and also a supervisor. His main job is in the Procedures and Development Office, working on new procedures and equipment. Now, Adam also acts as deputy manager of the ATC team at the Riyadh Air Show held at RAF Fairford in the UK. He's also a member of the UK Air Transport Confidential Human Factors Incident Reporting Program. That's a mouthful. That's sort of the equivalent of the NASA ASRS system that we have here in the States. And he's a member of various international working groups on low visibility ops, satellite-based navigation, and radar systems. So, Adam, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be on the show with you guys. And, you were the first podcast I think I actually ever listened to. I think it was about episode 30 or 40.
Wow.
I think I was trying to find it back in the archive earlier on the website. But when Dan was still around, and so actually you guys got me into podcasts, listening to podcasts. But looking forward to a great show.
Great.
We're sorry about that.
It can be a time.
Apology accepted.
Hard to believe. So you listened to us and you've stuck around all these years, huh?
I know. It's
funny.
Funny as it may seem.
Thanks a lot.
Very good. Yeah, we appreciate it. All right, well, why don't we get started with some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready from the East.
And ready from the UK.
Our first story.
Okay, I'm going to say this under protest.
What?
Oh, I want people to know that I tried to make this a Max-free podcast. Then I realized I'd have a problem with that, and I'd be doing all the editing. So we're going to keep this Max minimum or the 737 minimum. I tried, guys, but they want to talk about it.
Well, because the big news, of course, everybody knows by now, probably is last week, the United States lifted the ban on the Boeing 737 MAX. In fact, this happened on November 20th when the FAA issued AD 2020-24-02 airworthiness directives to Boeing company airplanes. And what that did is that superseded the earlier airworthiness directive, 2018-2351, which applied to all Boeing company model 737-8 and -9 or MAX airplanes. The 2018 AD required revising certificate limitations and operating procedures of the airplane flight manual, the AFM, and to provide the flight crew with runaway horizontal stabilizer trim procedures to follow under certain conditions. So we have the new AD out. We can talk a little bit about maybe an overview of what it includes, the actions included in the AD. Of course, there's a revision to the 737 MAX flight control laws that require inputs from both AOA sensors in order to activate MCAS. You'll recall in the accidents, there was just one angle of attack sensor. So now two are required, and you need inputs from both of them. The inputs have to be compared from the two sensors, and if they differ significantly, then that will disable the speed trim system, which includes MCAS, for the remainder of the flight. So what's the definition of differ significantly? Greater than 5.5 degrees for a specified period of time. Also, only one activation of MCAS per sensed high AOA event, and it also limits the magnitude of any MCAS commands to move the horizontal stabilizer such that, and this is from the AD, such that the resulting position of the stabilizer will preserve the flight crew's ability to control the airplane's pitch by using only the control column. Other changes, the flight control computer integrity monitoring of each FCC's, the flight computer's performance and cross-FCC monitoring, which detects and stops erroneous generated stabilizer trim commands, including MCAS. Also, the flight crew's procedures are revised in the AFM to facilitate the crew's ability to recognize and respond to desired horizontal stabilizer movement and the effects of a potential AOA sensor failure. There's also an AOA disagree alert. Do AOA sensors come up with something different? Also, and this is kind of different, and this is kind of the long pole in the tent, if you will, of the changes that have to be made. All these other changes, I believe, are software changes that can be made with an update. But there is a hardware change, and this is adequately separating certain airplane wiring and conducting an AOA sensor system test in an operational readiness flight on each airplane before the airplane is reintroduced into service. There's also some training requirements that are changed. So now, of course, this is just the FAA at this point, although some have indicated that some of the other organizations, regulatory organizations around the world have indicated that they're moving towards this as well, and others are silent. So are we at the beginning of the end of all this terrible time?
Yeah, clearly we are. This is essentially the FAA's final order, if you will, as to what has to happen. And I think the roadmap hasn't been, you know, totally clear over the last, what's it been now, 2 years?
Almost,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and now this is really this is the final roadmap with the exit ramp clearly laid out. So yeah, I think it's just a matter of the basic blocking and tackling, the implementation of the order at this point, which is great for Boeing, great for the airlines that want to get those aircraft back into service.
Yeah, it definitely is. There is still a lot of work to be done. There are all those aircraft in storage, and we see that Southwest Airlines has sent some mechanics to Victorville, California, where I guess they have 34 MAX jets parked, and they are going to start the process of getting them out of storage. There's also the process of updating the software and the process of making those changes to the wiring. But I guess maybe the interesting thing to see near term is, do the other regulatory agencies line up with this in sort of a quick manner? I don't know, Adam, any feedback from the UK?
Not that I'm aware of. I know EASA, they did the overall European Aviation Safety Agency had their final test flights in September, I think, which were conducted in Canada, Vancouver. So I think they're just in the process of analysing the results of those test flights. I guess it wouldn't be long, but I've got no other information, to be honest, on that.
I think a big question is, what is China going to do? Because the 737 MAX, I think China's the biggest market for that airplane in terms of the number of orders. And I think, at least as we record this, China has been silent on what they're going to do. I have a theory that China might remain silent until the inauguration. We have this trade issue with China going on, and that gives China some leverage, perhaps. So, you know, they may want to exercise that leverage such that their decision is based more on political considerations than the airworthiness of the aircraft considerations. But I guess we'll see.
And you mentioned the aircraft that Southwest is going to be pulling out of mothballs. Boeing's got 450 MAXs that essentially have never been delivered. They're just have piled up in the last 2 years, have been in storage. And so they're going to have to start going through all of those and bringing them up to the new software standards and hardware changes and get them ready to go. Boeing is saying that they'll probably get about half of those delivered over the next year, which tells you that, if they built 450 in 2 years, but are only going to deliver, half of those within the third year, obviously their order rate has dropped down substantially. They've pulled a thousand orders out of their backlog. So they have lost a tremendous number of aircraft. Now, that's not to say that all of those necessarily are because of the problems with the 737 MAX. Some of them may indeed have been caused by the pandemic, which has also hurt air travel around the world. Southwest, by the way, has announced just in the last week that they're adding a lot of new city pairs. It looks like they are concentrating them in some new mini hub cities. So I have a feeling they're actually going to be ready and willing to deploy these new 73 MAXs relatively soon to start flying with these new city pairs. Interesting strategy. When air traffic is down, a lot of companies pull back. Here, Southwest seems to be using it as an opportunity to expand.
Yeah, I think one of the tasks for Boeing in terms of getting these airplanes delivered is matching the rate at which they are deliverable to the demand for them, right? A lot of airlines don't want them right now. So, I mean, that's kind of a little bit of a pressure relief perhaps on Boeing, whereas if we hadn't been in the middle of this pandemic-caused downturn in air travel, it might have been a different issue for Boeing to try to get these things delivered. But right now, they just need to match the pull from the airlines.
And they also need to, it's going to be a ramp up kind of thing. I mean, the first couple of, especially with the rewiring part, the first 10 or 15 are going to be a lot slower than the next 30. I mean, eventually it'll get progressive, and then you'll actually have ones coming off the line that match already the ones that are out in the field. So, I mean, this is World War II production changes for like ball turrets. you implemented the change on the line, but you also implemented the change on the field, and eventually they met up with each other. So, I mean, it's been done before, but it's going to be – I'm wondering if they're going to have to go back, if we're going to revisit this, say, 6 months from now or a year after the first couple are coming up, to see if the directorate is actually meeting the standards and everything's getting wired and updated in proper ways, and or do we have lots of spinning windows on cockpit monitors because they haven't gotten the updates yet? So it's Boeing better be very methodical about this given their current situation.
Well, I also understand that, unlike in the past, in this case, each aircraft that gets delivered has to be signed off by the FAA. And I think that's different than in the past where, you know, Boeing would self-certify that these are ready to, an aircraft is ready to be delivered. But I think there's an increased role for the FAA here, which will add a little bit of time.
Is that for the retrofit or is that new ones also coming off the line?
I believe it's both.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that builds an infrastructure in there that your Boeing's not used to having. You're going to have FAA permanently, you know, sitting at the end of the line going, preparing to certify if they've got the new ones. I understand doing it for the retrofit, but for the new ones too, that's kind of impressive.
Yeah, and if I'm wrong, somebody will correct me. All right, we have an item that Micah sent in. This is from Bloomberg. Delta skirts Trump tariffs by sending Airbus jets on world tour. You know, people get this so clever. As part of the Boeing-Airbus subsidy battle, tariffs were placed on European-built Airbus aircraft in October last year, 2019. And since then, Delta has taken delivery of 7 planes, but instead of flying them to the United States and importing them and having to pay tariffs, Delta was very clever and they based them overseas. That was a way they could avoid the tariff because they weren't imports. Now, in a statement to Bloomberg News, Delta said, "We have made the decision not to import any new aircraft from Europe while these tariffs are in effect. Instead, we have opted to use the new aircraft exclusively for international service, which does not require transportation." Because it goes to the definition of what is a new aircraft. And it turns out that once you fly a plane for any reason other than testing or delivery, it's considered used. So if you fly it first, it becomes used. The tariff is only on new aircraft, so you avoid the tariff. Pretty clever.
Yeah, and the devalue the moment you come off the parking lot is dramatically decreased also.
Yeah, and it sounds like either the administration, when they were writing this particular rule, had this in mind, or perhaps the writing of the law was just loose enough and they didn't realize that this loophole had been created. So hard to know why they're able to do this, but it's clearly allowed in the legislation.
It is. It absolutely is. And it really does kind of feel like it was contemplated. The best part of the whole article is the quote from Richard Abalafia from Teal Group. "Richard's insightful comments will spice up just about any article on aviation." And he says, "It might just be sloppy writing of the law, which would be consistent with the current administration's aviation trade policies." And then alternatively, he said, "Delta may just be running out the clock on the Trump administration, since the Biden administration is less likely to fight trade wars with allies." Way to go, Richard.
He's not wrong.
Richard's hardly ever wrong. Here's a story from Airport Watch. Suspension of airport 80-20 slot usage rule to last till end of March 2021. Gatwick not happy. So, Adam, this relates to requirements for slot usage.
Yes.
European regulations.
Yeah, so basically there's the distribution of slots within certain European airports is a regulated activity. There are organisations, there's one in the UK called ACL, Airport Coordination Limited, that runs the slot system for, is it five or six of the busier UK airports, including Heathrow and Gatwick. And you might have seen in the news, you know, in the previous years anyway, not this year, but previous years, that a slot pair at Heathrow was sold by an airline to another airline for $75 million or something like this. So these slots actually have quite a high monetary value. The European Union permitted, once the impact of the pandemic became obvious, the European Union permitted an alleviation of this rule, which forces airlines to fly 80% of their slots. Otherwise, they will lose them when they come to get the next season. So there's a summer season and a winter season. The 80-20 rule, as it's called, means that the airlines that possess slots at these certain airports have to fly them, at least 80% of them. So they can't just buy a load of slots and then not fly them and keep their aircraft on the ground and save money and force other airlines to fly from other airports. So it's an anti-competitive, a competitive sort of regulation, antitrust type of regulation. When the pandemic first came in and the impact was seen to be serious, the European Union allowed an alleviation of this rule. So airlines are not having to fly empty aircraft everywhere because to occupy these slots in effect. But obviously some airports are now trying to put pressure on the regulators to say, well, actually, we need the airlines to fly their aircraft because either they're all moving to other airports or, you know, and my airport's losing money. So the competition between airports in Europe is while it might have been on the back burner for a few months, it's coming back now. So that's the context behind this story.
The motivation, perhaps, for Gatwick is to if some slots open up, then other airlines can come in. The article mentions, you know, Wizz Air and, you know, other, you know, low cost carriers could come in.
Yes. Yeah.
Another UK item. This is in Simple Flying. Heathrow staff to strike for 4 days in December. So apparently, London's Heathrow Airport wants to cut costs by reducing wages. There's a large trade union, Unite, and they say that the airport plans to fire some 4,000 workers and then rehire them at lower wages, which, that would be cause for concern if you're one of the 4,000 or a union representing them. Adam, you must belong to a union, but not this one.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, it's not this union, but yes, that most UK air traffic controllers belong to a union. Yes.
Yeah, I would assume so. The membership of this Unite union voted in favor of these strikes in protest. Some 85% of the union membership voted in favor. And Unite, I guess they represent a pretty wide spectrum of job types, you know, engineers to firefighters to baggage operators and just a wide variety. So if they do go on strike, that'll effectively shut down the airport.
Yeah, there's certainly some key staff groups in there. The firefighters being, of course, one of the ones that comes to mind first. And that's something that, you know, as the dates get closer, that in an air traffic control capacity, we'll obviously be working with the airport to try and mitigate, you know, obviously the safety impact there. So there might be, and we've seen it with other strikes in the past, airline strikes, they will charter in other airlines to fly their flights for them, to operate their flights for them. And I think that we're getting geared up to potentially having different providers of firefighting services on the airfield. So it's something that certainly we're going to have to work closely with and to ensure that they're happy operating on an airfield that they're not familiar with potentially.
Any drone operators trying to disrupt the airflow of Heathrow? Like, seems to me it was only this time last year that we were dealing with that.
Yes, that's true, isn't it, David? Yes, we get drone reports daily from pilots reporting. You know, either they've sighted a drone, usually on approach. So for those not familiar, the airport at Heathrow is to the west of London, and it's a predominantly a westerly wind. So aircraft are usually coming into land over the city of London, which obviously has millions of people living there. So yes, drones around Heathrow are, well, on the one hand, they're a problem, and we're always on the lookout for trying to mitigate those. But also, we at the airport, not specifically air traffic control, but certainly the airport and various companies at the airport use drones themselves for, we even use them now for taxiway inspections. If they've closed a bit of taxiway to resurface, rather than driving around in a car, they'll get some drones out and fly around to inspect the surface. They'll do it to inspect like the real high up on the A380's vertical stabilizer, because it's so high up, you know, scaffolding takes a long time to erect up there. They're inside the hangar, they'll fly a drone up and have a look and inspect it. So you know, we're also using drones as an airport in quite a few different capacities.
Just out of curiosity, are airport employees operating the drones, or has that been outsourced to a drone company, basically?
I think in many cases it's an outside company. Yeah. That's a specialist drone operator. Right. And I'm sure it's the same in the US, but in the UK there's lots of legal and certification requirements for commercial operators of drones. So yeah, it's usually a third party company that come in to operate the drones. We have to sit down with them and talk through how we can best fit in how the airport works in terms of aircraft and moving around the both on the surface and in the air with how they want to operate their drones and whether we can sort of come to an arrangement.
Sorry, I derailed it, Max. It's just, I just remembered that story last year at Heathrow with the people wanting to, on the strike, they wanted to disrupt the airflow. It was just, It was sort of like one of those first times. It was sort of, there's first time for everything. So, but thanks, Adam.
The first strike is planned for December 1st. That's supposed to be a 24-hour strike. And then the second is planned for December 14th, another 24-hour strike. And then the third is December 17th through the 18th, and that's a 48-hour-long strike. What's the advice if you're traveling? Don't try to schedule around those days, maybe?
I guess so, yeah. I don't have any inside information on what's going to happen. It's just another thing that we're going to have to work around, I guess. See what happens.
All right. Well, Max Trescott, I hear some kind of a little inkling about you being interested in some kind of speed dating event.
Oh, please, please. I hope my wife does not hear this. You're going to get me in huge trouble. Because I never said that was the case. No, but I did find a very interesting use of aircraft. And we've had a number of these stories during the pandemic of airlines who've come up with creative ways to try and put their aircraft back in service to raise some revenue. This comes out of Taiwan. EVA Air is now using their aircraft for speed dating events, in which they will take 20 men and 20 women. I don't know what they pay to do this for the event, but they are boarded for a three-hour flight. And it's kind of interesting. They don't get to choose their seats. Instead, the seating is by lucky draw. So I'm sure they still arrange it, boy, girl, things like that. And I'm sure you also have the opportunity once you're on the flight to move around and talk with other people. But you've got 3 hours to meet people on the airplane. Participants have to be between the ages of 28 and 38. For the men, the women between 25 and 34. So that's really kind of interesting. They've got kind of a 3-4 year difference bias toward having younger women and older men on the flight. Don't know how they came up with that.
That's because the men need to grow up.
Well, in fact, I mean, that was my first reaction too. So there are these mismatched age requirements. Also, interestingly, before I forget, is that all of them must have university degrees as well as Taiwanese citizenship. But some people have been thinking, questioning this. Well, why sort of younger women, and slightly older men? And the airline says, in their defense, they say, from different surveys we have done, This is not a shock. Most of the male participants would like to meet women younger than them. And then at the same time, they say that while female participants would like to meet men older than them, that's why there's a different age criteria for the event.
All comments such and such should be sent to Max Trescott.
That's right.
At airplanegeeks.com, because he brought up this story. But, you know, but Max, you know, we've talked about the hotels and the dinners and now the dating. It's all been Asian airlines that have been doing this.
So
I don't remember there being any of the American airlines doing it. I don't remember any of the European airlines doing it. The Asian market seems to think out of the box.
I think we may have had a story out of Australia or New Zealand along these lines, but you're right. Okay, I can't think of any.
That's Pan Pacific. I mean, we talked about Singapore. Now we talked about EVA. JAL did something. I mean, it's interesting that innovation culture from in Asia over us here in the States, who, you know, we can't even slip peanuts aboard an airplane, you know, let alone figure out something that, you know, taxi around a flight line and provide a dating service. You know, I think we need to start an AvGeek dating service.
Oh, no.
Well, by the way, I agree with you on out-of-the-box thinking. The out-of-the-box thinking for the U.S. airlines is, let's just ground these airplanes and put them in Victorville. That seems to be their reaction to the pandemic.
But there must be a market, because I don't remember what the article said. Was there a price for the three-hour tour?
Yeah, I saw $295.
$100 an hour. I mean, if you go out on a date, you know, a reasonable date, you might fork over $150 for dinner.
Wow. I mean, so I would never spend that much on dinner. I'm too cheap.
Well, it varies a lot whether metro areas, rural areas.
Yeah, I know. Like I'm just kidding. So.
And these days, you can't find a restaurant open to save your life anyway. So
indoor dining.
So outdoor dining here in Pennsylvania in 45 degrees is not fun. I don't know. I approve of the creativity. The sort of misogynistic overtones makes me uncomfortable. But yeah, I approve the creativity, and good for them. They're at least giving the opportunity for their flight crews to be employed, you know, and sometimes that's what you need to do.
There's one other little twist to this. It says that after the three-hour ride, it says the full circle trip, which I guess is the ride in the airplane, will then be followed by a two-hour date back on land. So I guess, you know, you're looking during that 3 hours to see, hey, is there somebody that I'd like to then have a two-hour date with afterwards?
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, with a three-hour tour, you have to worry about the weather getting rough and the tiny plane being tossed.
A reference to Gilligan's Island TV show.
Worry about the crew, you know, the captain and Gilligan. So it's just you got to take your chances. Dating is kind of a nightmare these days.
And if you watch TV in the U.S. in the 1960s, you know what David's talking about.
Yes.
Or 70s or 80s.
Oh, the reruns.
The reruns. All right. Norwegian Air Shuttle is in the news, and they're having a tough time.
You know, we've talked about Norwegian Air many, many times, and they have had challenges over the last couple of years. There's no question that the long-haul discount market has always been a tough nut to crack, just because you don't have really quite the same cost savings that you have in kind of domestic, you know, discount short-haul kinds of markets. There have been base closures here in the U.S. About a year ago. And it always seemed like Norwegian was just having a tough time making it all work. And sure enough, they just filed for bankruptcy protection in Ireland on this past week. And so I guess that's going to allow them to continue to operate. But this is kind of the acknowledgement of what I think a lot of us kind of suspected. This is just a very, very tough business to be in. And by the way, this we've talked in the past about WOW Airlines.
Scandinavian dating tours, you know.
There you go. That's one way to go. You know, we've talked in the past about WOW Airlines. Did you happen to notice in the last week the story about Mom Airlines, which of course would be WOW turned upside down?
Oh, that was great. But it wasn't. Was that? It was an Onion story, though, right?
No, actually, I mean, it could have been. It turned out that there was an artist who, as a project, created this fake airline called Mom Airlines. And they had complete with a website, all the marketing information, press conferences, launch video on Facebook or YouTube, something like that.
Bright pink airplane.
And he writes that, I said, I got 6,000 bookings, 200 complaints, 2 comments per minute on social media, 10,000 people watched their 41-minute long launch video. He finally had to cut the thing off early because there were folks like lawyers from WOW Airlines, which is planning to relaunch, were trying to figure out, is this really an airline or not? Some of the gimmicks included free seats, which they were offering because they said they'd make it up because people would have to buy the return ticket. And they were also going to do some things that we've kind of joked about in the past. But according to the Mom Airlines, they were going to be charging not only for seat assignments, in-flight Wi-Fi and cabin bags, but also toilet paper, soap, and even life jackets.
Oh, God. Well, so, you know, just take a book out of Ryanair.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess a lot of people believe this and, you know, booked space on Mom Airlines before he finally decided, all right, the jig is up and I might as well let people know that this was kind of a fun project.
Wow, it's a pretty extensive project for
a lot of work.
Yeah, that's great. I like it. We have an item from AIN Online. This is autonomous electric tow tugs could cut handling costs. There's a startup in California. It's called Moonware. I don't know why it's called Moonware, but they say that the aviation industry is stagnant, and they want to do something about it. Stagnant is their word. So Moonware says they are, quote, building an AI-powered fleet management network and subsequently deploying autonomous and electric vehicles to fundamentally reshape airport operations. So, Max, what are they looking to do here?
Yeah, I thought it was kind of intriguing because I had never heard of anybody looking to automate this part of aviation. But we all have seen those large tugs that move in when it's time to back an aircraft up prior to taking off, and it looks like they want to develop large tugs that can pull airliners around with much as, 600,000 pounds. So these are not, little toys. These are going to be very large tugs, which they say will be able to move between predetermined waypoints such as gates, taxiways, and runways. But you could imagine, for example, maintenance would probably love to have something like this if you've got to move an aircraft from the gate over to the maintenance hangar or, even to do pushbacks. They've got proposed on the system onboard LIDAR, which is light detection and ranging sensors to avoid collisions with other aircraft, ground support vehicles, and buildings. So we've talked a lot about automation in the cockpit. Here's automation under the cockpit.
Yeah. Automated vehicles moving aircraft around on the airport.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
Yeah. Adam, you care to chime in? This is just aircraft movements. It's your specialty.
Well, we have electric mini tugs at the moment at Heathrow. They're not autonomous, though. They are controlled by somebody. So rather than having a big, carbon-producing tow truck with a guy driving it and a guy on the headset, or possibly even 3 crew driving the tug and handling the pushback. There's only one person, so obviously there's a staff-saving cost there. And they generally are a bit quicker, but they're electric-powered, battery-powered. They push an aircraft back and then go back to their house on the stand and recharge, a bit like a Roomba vacuum. But as I say, they're controlled by somebody, wireless or on a wired connection, almost like a remote control toy car. And I know this concept doesn't strike me I think possibly the automation part of it is relatively new. But I know Airbus and Safran were working on something they called e-taxi for quite a few years, where it was effectively a little electric tug that would tow, I think, something up to A320 size out to the, you know, the holding point of the runway, and then the engines would start, and so you're saving that carbon emission on the taxi. But yeah, I would probably be a bit concerned operating autonomous vehicles on the surface of an airport, certainly a complex airport. There's just so many things there to potentially fool the algorithm that I'm sure we've seen in social media over the last few weeks, some classic examples of artificial intelligence going wrong. There was certainly in the UK, there was at some of the smaller soccer matches, they have automatic camera tracking the ball. And one of the linesmen, one of the referees, had a rather bald head, and in the sunlight, it looked to the camera like a soccer ball. So the camera was following the head of the linesman rather than the ball. So everybody watching the TV wasn't watching the football; they were just watching a man run up and down the sideline. So there's always going to be a situation where artificial intelligence and algorithms won't be able to account for. So you know, I think the safety assurance work on this sort of thing would be rather extensive.
Hey, let me tell you a really quick tug story. This is something that's little known, but a few years ago in Long Beach, California, where JetBlue had a base, in the wee hours of the night, something like 2 a.m., two baggage handlers who were bored decided to take a tug and start driving around on the property. And they found out how to turn off the governor on the tug so they could get it to go up at high speed. So they were careening around, and at one point they didn't make a turn, and they smashed into a Cessna 150, which had an ELT on it, which started going off, which then brought people to investigate to find out, hey, why do we have an aircraft which has crashed while tied down at the airport? And they matched the color of the paint on the 150 with the JetBlue colors, and they said, we think we have an idea what happened here. So the FAA came along with their badges, and they said, let's take these two young gentlemen, put them in two separate rooms, and see who talks first. And they got some confessions, and unfortunately, I think those guys lost their jobs. But, you know, there's an example of some artificial intelligence. They didn't have real intelligence.
Yeah.
what a dumb stunt to pull.
Well, we talk about autonomy. The Navy, the X-47B, which is going to be the Navy aerial refueler drone, one of the things that Northrop Grumman is developing to go with it is the autonomous tug that will tow it around the aircraft carrier.
Oh.
You know, where if it's not fully autonomous, it'll be semi-autonomous, that they'll be able to drive it from below decks to park and position the aircraft for takeoff and landing, et cetera. So the Navy was experimenting, and that's a lot of guts if you're going to run an autonomous tug on a flight deck of an aircraft carrier. There's not a lot of room for screw-ups there. So, you know.
So, David, I was going to say, actually, Max, do you think there's a market for an autonomous podcast editing system where you just give it the files and it edits everything for you?
Oh, yeah. 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 There's definitely a market for that.
Sign me up.
Yeah. If you can figure that out, yeah, you'll be rich.
Well, speaking of naval aviation, David, we see that there is a new addition to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum that's rather interesting.
Well, we've talked about the Smithsonian, that in order to be in the Smithsonian, you aren't just an airplane. You have to have – there's something else there. The Blue Angels effectively have retired their legacy Hornets. That would be classics for those boys down under, but here in the States we call them legacies, so the ABCDs. They're in the process of transitioning into E's and F's, so they're – their current batch of C's and D's are going off to the museum. Well, the Air and Space Museum at Dulles acquired Bruno 163439, which, besides being a Blue Angel, was one of the first carrier-based F-18 C's in the Navy. So it's been around for 33 years. The last five plus, it's been flying as a Blue Angel. But this aircraft has flown missions in Desert Storm, Desert Shield, Iraqi Freedom. It has a really long military legacy, long before it became an aerobatic jet with the Blue Angels. So that's why when the Blue Angels, when the Navy offered the Smithsonian the option of getting one, needless to say, the Smithsonian went through and looked at all the records to show it's more than just a Blue Angel. It's an aircraft with serious history behind it and like six or seven different squadrons as well as the Blue Angels. And the link in the show notes will have the complete history on it. But again, you have to be, you're not just an airplane, you're a special airplane when you go to Dulles, because they only have so much room and so much space. And it's the first F-18. It's probably the only F-18 they're going to have. But that being said, it's one with substantial history, besides being just a blue jet with yellow wings that flew every weekend. So a really good story, a really good acquisition. And I'm pretty sure they're going to keep it in Blue Angel blue. But it tells a story about aerobatics as well as combat.
And they flew it into Dulles, right? This wasn't something that arrived on a truck in pieces.
Nope. It was flown in by the commander of the Blue Angels. And as we know on the show, because we've done things, there is a taxiway that's located between the museum and Dulles Airport. So they literally taxied it up to the back door of the Smithsonian, and it's now in the hangar and getting demilled and ready for exhibition. So if, unfortunately, due to circumstances, I actually was thinking going this week, but then they decided to close the museum down due to the COVID, so and with an indefinite opening. So the next time we get there, hopefully she'll be sitting there in the restoration hangar next to things like flak bait, you know, and eventually she'll get out on the floor.
When a military aircraft it goes into a museum and has to be, like you say, demilled, does the military get involved in sort of, or somebody else sort of certifying that process, or does the museum handle all aspects of that? Do you know?
It's usually handled by I'll give you an example. Willow Grove had an F-14 before the Navy recovered it, but it was flown into the airfield. It was then taxied up to the main hangar. It was shut down, and then they proceeded to take out the major functions so the engines wouldn't start. Then usually there's a team of about eight people from the Navy who take out all the sensitive, anything else. They make sure that it's incapable of flying. You know, now at the Smithsonian, that's a completely different ball game, because the Smithsonian, it's considered what they call an article of record. This, when you, and this, we've talked about this with Discovery, that this F-18 is the intention that 100 years from now, if somebody wants to see an F-18C and they go to the Smithsonian, it will look like the way it was turned over to the museum now. And that's what people can use as an artifact that was from the 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2000, up through the 2020s. As a general rule, for most museums, an aircraft gets flown in and basically they make sure it never flies again. And that's usually done by the military. Especially with the F-14s, it was vitally important because they did not want the spare parts to be transported to Iran.
Right.
So they were really hypersensitive over the engines and things. But it's pretty easy to stuff a bird. To use a Thanksgiving thing where you're making it so it's not and the same thing goes with warbirds. You know, they're not the same. They don't have the armaments. They don't have the necessary mechanisms so that they can do things that they could do in the military. But we still have them. That's a good thing.
Again, we're speaking with Adam Spink. Adam, we're glad to have you on the show, especially such a longtime Airplane Geeks listener. That's always cool. I want to talk about a couple of different things. One is time-based separation. I mean, this is something that's, I think, been operating at Heathrow for a little while, but wasn't Heathrow kind of a bit of a leader in that regard?
Yes, yeah. So as far as I'm aware, we're still the only airport in the world that uses this sort of tool for arrival separation. Although there are various airports around the world that are introducing it, they're going through. I know Toronto and Amsterdam at the moment. We're doing work with them to help them introduce it. So basically, to give the listeners an idea, arriving aircraft at airports are, well, any aircraft is classified by its wake vortex category. So you have heavies, you have mediums, you have lights. Some states and nations might subdivide them even further. In the UK, we had six categories. So to try and reduce the separations a bit as you get more granular between each category. So, for example, a 747 or a 777 might be a heavy. An A320 or a 737 will be a medium. And air traffic control will separate these aircraft by distance on approach. So a heavy followed by a medium will be 5 miles. A heavy followed by a heavy will be 4 miles. And that's pretty much the same, give or take, around the world. The problem you find when you are at a very busy airport, such as certainly what Heathrow used to be up until March this year, in terms of runway capacity, is that when you get to a strong headwind scenario, the landing rate will go down. So, for example, in a 5-knot headwind, a 4-mile gap will be 90 seconds, will equate to 90 seconds. So the first aircraft lands, and if it's the next aircraft is 4 miles behind, in a 5-knot headwind, the second one will touch down 90 seconds later. In a 20-knot headwind, that same 4 miles will now equate to nearly 110 seconds. So for every pair of aircraft, you've lost 20 seconds because the aircraft are flying slower over the ground. In the UK, we have some of our highways have road markings and road signs saying stay 2 dots apart for the car in front. And it's a similar scenario. If you're driving at 70 miles an hour and you stay 2 dots apart, then the road has a certain throughput. If you all slow down to 20 miles an hour, I know I'm exaggerating, but if you slow down to 20 miles an hour and still keep 2 dots apart, the throughput of the road is dramatically reduced. So at Heathrow and a lot of other airports that are constrained in capacity terms, they would struggle with a strong headwind. Now, what some of our sort of boffins decided is that, well, for a start, the wake vortex that we're protecting the following aircraft from encountering with arrival separation degrades quicker when the wind is stronger and more turbulent. So the wake vortices coming off of each wingtip will be weaker the stronger the wind is. And also, if we could develop some sort of system that could determine the exact wind conditions down the final approach, we could, rather than separating by distance by 4 miles regardless of the wind, we could separate by 90 seconds. And therefore, in a strong headwind, that might equate to 3.6 miles rather than 4. And actually, potentially in a tailwind or in calm conditions, which is actually when the wake vortices stay around for longer, they persist, and they're stronger when the following aircraft arrives at that point, we can increase the spacing because we can say, well, actually, if we take the baseline as a 5-knot headwind, if the wind is less than a 5-knot headwind or it's a tailwind, we can increase the spacing. So we've gone from, if in a 20-knot headwind, we went from a landing rate of maybe 36 to 37 aircraft per hour to a landing rate of 40 to 42 aircraft an hour. And if you extrapolate that over 16, 17 hours of the day, that's a lot of aircraft, more aircraft you're landing with this tool. The problem as an air traffic controller is, how do you visualize 90 seconds on a radar screen? You can't. So We would then convert that 90 seconds back into a distance, modified by the headwind component, and say, okay, yeah, this was a 4 mile gap, is now 3.7 or 3.8 or 3.9 miles. Air traffic controllers, we like to think we're quite good at our jobs. We're possibly not good enough to, again, judge 0.1 miles to that accuracy level on a radar screen. So we actually draw a line. So we see where the first aircraft is on the radar. We know the second aircraft, the minimum spacing is, let's say, 3.8 miles. So we'll draw a little indicator 3.8 miles behind that aircraft, and it will follow that aircraft down the approach. So rather than the radar controller thinking, I need to be 4 miles behind that, I'll vector it, or I'll change the heading by another 10 degrees, I'll slow it down, I'll change the heading by another 10 degrees to try and achieve an imaginary position 4 miles behind the aircraft. They're actually aiming the aircraft at an indicator on the radar screen as it travels down the approach. So that aids the radar controller in achieving that precise spacing down to 0.1 mile increments. And it's a really good system. And there were concerns when it was first being introduced that this would potentially de-skill the controller. They might not be able to perform as efficiently if they were only. It's similar in a way to following a sat nav or some the magenta line in the cockpit type thing, but I think a lot of it's a really good system, and it certainly helped us. We've gone from a landing rate of 38 an hour arrivals in a strong headwind day to maybe 40 to 42, and that all adds up over the day. Yeah.
So is the driving factor in this how to increase the number of landing fees collected?
Yeah. It wasn't quite that. It was basically to reduce the impact of delays. That was the main reason. And another big issue we've had to cope with over the last maybe 12 years or so is the A380. We're one of the top A380 airports in the world, and especially with a constrained runway, even before the A380 turned up, and then having to add one or two extra miles on the separation behind each A380, suddenly the delays would start to increase quite significantly, the more A380s you added in every day. So we're looking at, we spent quite a lot of money, both us as an air traffic provider and the airport, on research and development of various tools. Time-based separation is one of these to mitigate the impact of the A380 in some ways.
I'm curious, do you have the same kind of flow control program that we have here in the U.S. to avoid congestion? So, for example, if we know that more than 100 planes are going to land in Los Angeles and the capacity is 60, the planes will sit on the ground all over the country until their slot comes up. How do you handle that if you've got planes launching from, China coming into Heathrow?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Yes, we do, and it's a European-wide system, including actually some countries that sit just outside Europe, but within sort of the sphere of influence, as it were. So we have exactly the same, all the flight plans are analyzed by a central computer in there's one in Brussels and one in France. And like you said, if let's say Heathrow have declared a capacity of 40 arrivals an hour, and the system thinks, well, there's 43 with flight plans to arrive in that hour, it will issue departure slot times for the three aircraft that it needs to move back to the next hour, and probably issue slot times for all the 40 others to make sure they turn up when they say they're going to turn up. For aircraft that depart, that come into the European area from outside Europe, then yes, we cannot modify their flow rate because they're already in the air. By the time you become aware that a situation has evolved or weather has changed or there's fog, then you can't do anything about that. So we have to take account of those already and work around them with our flow control.
Got it. And I think we have the same thing in the U.S. I think typically it's the short-haul flights that are the ones that get postponed the plane from New York has already launched 5 hours before. You can't do anything about it.
Adam, this is probably the dorky question of the day, but is it departures that drive the system or is it the arrivals? We've just spent a lot of time talking about arrivals into the airport. How does that blend in with the departures. Does one take premise over the other, a precedent over the other, or vice versa? I don't know.
I mean, each airport will be different depending on the mix of traffic it has and how highly scheduled it is. At Heathrow, before the pandemic hit, we were round about 99.7 to 99.8% scheduled to the capacity that we would declare. So any non-nominal event would impact the operation. So at Heathrow, arrivals were and still are to a certain extent the main focus, because the arrival separation is, if you look at a whole hour, is greater than the departure separation. So a normal landing hour for us would be 40 to 42 arrivals per hour. A normal departure hour for us, we could easily depart 50 to 52 without too much trouble. So we can recover quicker for departures than we can recover quicker for arrivals. And of course, departures, if you delay departures, they just sit at the gate, not burning any fuel. So there's no emissions, there's no noise. If you delay arrivals, they're all flying around various holding stacks 20 miles away from Heathrow, burning fuel, making, you know, creating emissions. So the focus was more on arrivals. However, because of tools like the time-based separation, arrivals have become more efficient. So we are now starting to look at departures. The next stage of this sort of whole sort of concept of optimizing the operations is what we call pairwise. So rather than looking at categories of aircraft, heavies, mediums, lights, etc., and having a 3x3 matrix of separations or even a 6x6 matrix of separations, we would go into a separate discrete separation value for a certain aircraft pair. So for example, a 777-300 followed by an A319 might be 3.2 mile separation. A 777-300 followed by an A320 might be 3.1 miles. A 777 followed by an A321 might be 3.0 miles. So the more, it comes back to that concept that I know a lot of the top athletes use about marginal gains. If you take a little bite here and a little bite there, and it all adds up over the course of the day. So we're looking at providing, so on arrivals, that would be to 0.1 mile increments for certain aircraft pairs. But on departures, we're looking at 10-second separation intervals as well, and going from whole minutes. So at the moment, if we have a larger followed by a smaller aircraft in the UK, it's a two-minute separation, regardless of aircraft type. If it's a heavy followed by medium, it's 2 minutes, or a heavy followed by light, it's 2 minutes. If we then go to pairs, discrete pairings of aircraft, we can really chop away at some of those excess separations. The issue with category-based separation is you have to assume it has to be safe for the heaviest heavy leading and the lightest aircraft following, and then anything.
So Max in a vision jet followed by an A380, huh?
Yeah.
They wouldn't worry about my wake turbulence, that's for sure.
Adam, just an observation. A couple of times you've mentioned emissions, and, you know, in the context of burning fuel, but you've really framed it as an emissions issue. And it just sort of strikes me that in the U.S., it would be about the cost of burning fuel, whereas, you know, you tend to look at it as the emissions that result from that wasteful or unnecessary burning of fuel. And I don't know. I don't know if you can, but I'm just thinking there's a difference in perception between Europe generally in the United States generally, in terms of, you know, environmental
culture
issues. And I think it's sort of become, you know, really clear just based on how you've approached those topics.
Yeah, I think that's possibly fair. I mean, as a national air traffic control provider, the company I work for, NATS, so as well as working in various air traffic or airport control towers, NATS also runs the two en route control centres that we have in the UK, one for the UK or the English FIR, information region and one for the Scottish, and also the northeast quadrant of the North Atlantic as well. We control that. One of our KPIs, key performance indicators, that determines our funding is based on an environmental scoring for each flight. So basically, we have a computer system called 3DI that looks at a flight from, well, each flight in turn, but for example, a flight from London to Paris. It'll look at its flight planned route and what the optimal level, according to the aircraft type and loading and weight, etc., what the optimum flight trajectory for that that particular flight would be. And then after the flight lands, the system will look at what it actually flew, and we as an air traffic control provider will get scored on that. It will provide us with a metric, and we have a target to meet every year. So, yeah, a lot of our focus, our research and development focus, is on the environmental aspects of aviation. So, yeah, it's certainly uppermost in our minds.
And the KPI for environmental, is that, I'm guessing, probably up in the upper 90s? I mean, percentage-wise, what kind of targets, ballpark, are you looking at?
To be honest, I don't know that much about it because I'm a tower controller rather than an en route controller. I think they play computer games. They think I'm a car park attendant. So there's a healthy rivalry between tower controllers and radar controllers. But it's a metric. It's I think the lower the score, the better. I think it's based about difference from the ideal. And I think the target at the moment is something like 2.9 or 3.0. I don't really know what that means. Yeah. It might be a percentage, but it's.
So tell us about your metrics. What kind of things are you measured on as a tower controller?
So as a tower controller, we're measured on aspects such as delays, both arrival and departure. There is a sort of an emissions aspect to that as well, in terms of reduced engine taxi. So if it's a two engine aircraft taxiing out, they might only use one engine and start the other up near the beginning of the runway. So we try and encourage that as much as possible. Delay at the holding point where aircraft are burning those two engines. So yeah, there are lots of environmental aspects that which we are measured on as well as tower controllers.
There's some differences here that are you know, very interesting to me.
I mean, I guess in the grand scheme of things, if it's environmentally friendly, it's usually more efficient for the airline as well. Therefore, it will be less expensive for the airline. So there's quite a high correlation between emissions, as you said, Max, about emissions and fuel burn equals cost. But another issue that we have in Europe is obviously each nation has its own air traffic control provider, has its own sovereign airspace, and each nation will charge aircraft flying through its airspace differently. So there's always that balancing act about, so for example, a flight from London to New York, for example, it might fly on the most efficient in terms of shortest track, bearing in mind the winds over the North Atlantic, and that will provide the least amount of fuel burn. However, airspace charges might mean it will fly a longer route, which will actually end up being less expensive for the airline because they don't have to pay as much airspace charge. So it's a very complex sort of... but then we might get involved as air traffic controllers at the tower and say, well, actually, if you file on this third different route, you won't be delayed by 10 minutes on stand, which the airline might attribute another financial cost to as well. So it's all, you know, it's a lot of balancing going on in terms of the least worst option.
Now here's something I'm sure American controllers will want to know, since you work for a private company. Is there a profit-sharing plan for controllers?
No. So the company I work for is, we call it a public-private partnership. So the model is similar to what NAV Canada have up to the north of the US there. And it's the government own 46%. I think this is off the top of my head, so it's probably wrong. And various other private companies own the rest. So we can buy shares in the company, but there's no profit sharing.
Yeah.
And as air traffic has decreased in the pandemic, has the company raised its rates for air traffic fees, or are they going to have to reevaluate that?
So in terms of the response to the pandemic, it's been a European sort of solution to the issue rather than each nation doing their own thing. So there's a European organization called Eurocontrol, which, as well as having its own en route control center in Europe over the top of Belgium at high level, it also takes on the administrative burden of collecting all those airspace fees, because Eurocontrol also run the flow control system. So they know they have all the flight plan data. They collect all the fees from airspace users and then distribute them to each state as appropriate. So it was a central European and European Union sort of decision. As soon as the seriousness of the pandemic was obvious, then the governments of Europe and Eurocontrol agreed that they would not charge airlines, and they would for 6 months, and then defer the next 6 months' payments. So we're currently sort of not really being paid by the airlines at the moment. I think they've just started again in the last month or so, but it's all been deferred. So it's a European solution rather than a UK.
And by contrast, I think I read recently that NAV Canada has increased their fees by 29%. So that's kind of the argument against user fees, is that when the company is trying to make a profit, then volume goes down. They've got to make it up somewhere.
I know we're running long, Mr. Flight, but I want to know, Adam, and feel free not to answer this question, but how's Brexit going to affect your job?
I don't.
That says it all right there.
To be honest, I don't think anybody knows, which is a bit worrying given that it's
coming fast.
Yeah. Coming it's about fast. nine or 10 days away or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting why you, it sounds like you're so tied into Europe. Breaking away out of that, it might not have any effect on you at all. It might have all the effect on it. It's going to be a challenge, I'm sure, for everything. And it's the devil is in the details, I'm sure.
Adam, one thing I wanted to ask you about NATS. When you're off at Riyadh doing air traffic control, is that a NATS job, or are you taking a vacation? And
yes, and I'm taking vacation time. It's
he wants to work a real air show.
Yeah. So NATS does sponsor. So Riyadh is a charity. Effectively, it raises money for the Royal Air Force Charitable Trust, which looks after RAF veterans and former and current serving members of the RAF. So NATS provides money to help with the accommodation costs of putting the controllers up near to RAF Fairford for a few days. And provides us with really nice pink polo shirts, just like the guys in Oshkosh.
That's right.
We all do it, in our own time. There's guys from all around the country turn up, it's not a NATS. I don't do it in company time. I do it in my own time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you guys all have to arm wrestle for who gets to go? I mean, how did you get selected?
So I've been going to air shows since before I can remember, and I've been going to the IAT and then Royal IAT in Riyadh for years and years, and I just got involved about 5 years ago or so. I got in touch with the guy who's just retired, who was the manager of the ATC team there, who used to work at Manchester Airport in the north of England. And he said, yeah, come along next year on one of the arrival and practice days and, see if you like it. And I went there and I liked it and said, yeah, I want to join. And we train two guys a year or two controllers a year as trainees. So whereas when I arrived at Heathrow, I probably spent 18 months in training and then did my sort of examination board with the Civil Aviation Authority. At Riyadh at Fairford, you arrive on the Tuesday evening, you have a quick training brief, and you train Wednesday and Thursday, and then on the Friday you have your examination board with the Civil Aviation Authority, and then you're controlling the air show on the Saturday, Sunday. So it's a quick turnaround.
So do I understand this correctly? You work as a controller, and for vacation, you control aircraft?
Yes, it's a bit sad, isn't it? But, I mean, it's I would probably equate it to, you know, an airline pilot who flies a 777 getting in a pit special or an extra or something, or a sailplane at the weekend. It's completely different to my day job. It's the same basic theory. I'm still a tower controller. At Heathrow, I've got loads of radar screens, load of automated tools to help me. At RAF Fairford, I'm using, with the greatest respect to the United States Air Force, relatively poor radios with a paper and a pen, and that's it. You know, there's no radar screen. There's no electronic strip displays. There's
and multiple countries sending multiple.
So it's completely different. The muscles I exercise working at REAT are completely different to the muscles that I use in my day job, and it's great fun. I love it.
I bet. As David mentioned, we're running a little bit long, but I have a plan, and it's not something that is going to positively impact the time management skills of my co-hosts, because I figure that's a lost cause. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to skip some of the things that we had scheduled for this episode, and we're actually going to get together with sort of a surprise guest, well, tomorrow night, and we're going to record that as next week's episode. So we're going to defer some of it. But there are a couple of things that we want to do. First of all, we want to thank Adam for being on the show. Adam, we could talk for a lot longer, so maybe we'll have another opportunity to do that, I hope.
Oh, I'd love to. Really enjoyed it. Thanks, Matt.
And thank you for staying up so late, because we are definitely not in your time zone. But one thing we wanted to talk about is the December issue of AOPA Pilot Magazine. This is Max, is this available to people who aren't members? They don't sell this on the newsstands or anything, do they?
No, they don't.
No, too bad. Because if you are a member of AOPA, as I am and as Mr. Trescott is, be sure you take a look at the December issue, because on page 30 of the December issue, in the pilot briefing section, there's an article called Listen Up by Ian Twombly. Now, there's a couple of great characteristics about Ian Twombly. For one thing, I love saying his name, because Twombly, you know, I just love to say Twombly. I don't know why. Another one that I can't explain is Jason Rabinowitz. I love saying Rabinowitz, and I don't know why. But anyway, I like to say Twombly.
And we should add, Ian is a great guy, by the way. I've known Ian for a dozen years and run into him at different places. And in fact, his dad was also, I think, worked for AOPA many years ago.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm especially liking Ian Twombly these days because of the December issue. So on that page 30, he has an article where he lists some favorite podcasts. And Airplane Geeks makes the list. Aviation News Talk podcast makes the list. A couple other notable Opposing Bases. There we go. There's an air traffic control podcast. Also, The Finer Points, which is actually something that we may be talking about in a few weeks' time, hopefully, in another context. So take a look. There's a group of podcasts there that Ian has assembled. And we're just really, really pleased and honored to be part of that list. Just as an aside, and this is something we're going to defer, one of our listener poll questions was, what podcasts do you listen to? And we have a great collection of responses for that. We'll do that, what you'll hear next episode, because we're running long. But if that's not enough...
There's more?
There's more. There's more in that December issue. And I hadn't gotten to it yet because it's on the very last page. The last page features Max Trescott. It's also by Ian. It's a great little peek at you, Mr. T.
Well, I must say that you know, for years as a pilot, I've always looked at that last page as one of the big honors in aviation, and only 12 people a year get to be there. And I don't know if this just means that I'm old now, and so I'm considered, you know, candidate for this. But yeah, it's a fabulous photo, and the title of it, it says, Max Truscott, it's all enjoyable, and it says, Cirrus instructor and author. And starts off, Max is very happy right where he is. Thank you very much. As a professional flight instructor, he has shunned the world of corporate and airline flying for something a little slower, lower, and a lot more fun. And that just kind of talks about what I do. And I love the photo.
It is a good photo.
They contacted me probably about in May out of the blue and said, hey, we were thinking maybe putting you in the magazine. Would you be interested? And they sent a photographer out, I want to say in June. And so we showed up in masks and went out to the airport and shot a whole bunch of different things. And they selected, I never saw the actual photos, but they selected this one with a Cirrus right on the yellow line of taxiway. And the line is blurred at the beginning of the photo, leaves right up to the front wheel of the Cirrus. And there I am off on the side, kind of leaning on the side of the cowling. So anyway, fun to see this happen. And I think I will always kind of treasure this as probably one of the most memorable things in aviation that's ever happened to me. So I'm very excited. I want to thank AOPA for deciding to contact me and include me.
Yeah, it's very cool. I'm going to keep that issue forever now. I'm serious. I will. Let's do a little bit of listener mail really quickly. We heard from Tom, and there was an accident recently at Whiteman Airport, and that's in California. Where is that, Max?
It's in Southern California. It's north of Los Angeles. It would be just north of the Burbank-Van Nuys area. So it's one of the very first airports you would get into as you start to get into the, you know, the L.A. region, if you will.
I guess as a result of this accident, there's at least one of the L.A. councilwomen, Monica Rodriguez, is calling for the airport to be closed. And there is a petition, a change.org petition, Save Whiteman Airport. And Tom sent us the link to that. And, well, it starts off, while we were all saddened to learn of the tragic death of this pilot in, how do you say the name of this place? Pacoima?
No. And this is something that I learned after I moved to California. It's Pacoima.
Pacoima. Oh, yeah. It kind of looks like Pacoima.
I would never have guessed
that. No, you wouldn't. It says, your assertion, and this is referring to the councilwoman, that Whiteman Airport poses a public safety threat to the community, which you believe derives no value from its operations, is not based in fact. In fact, it is wrong. And so we'll have a link to that change.org petition in the show notes, so you can take a look at that. And then we also heard from Mike, who's gotten kind of interested in autogyros and is asking us, hasn't heard a lot about autogyros on the show. He's been looking at the, the Magni gyro? These things always look just so cool. But he's asking for opinions of these kinds of small autogyros. We kind of need an autogyro expert. Have you ever, any of you ever flown in one of these things?
No, there are not that many of them.
David?
No, we've got a couple at Brandywine. What I did was there's a rotor freak down in Australia by the name of Grant McCarran, and I directed – he's a gyro fanatic, so I directed Mike to Grant to – they can feed off of each other's passion for unpowered rotor flight.
And it's a – it's a separate rating, by the way, so you can't use it with a private pilot's license. You need to be trained in it separately. And the challenge is that there are very few places in the United States where you can go to get trained to get that that certificate. And there aren't that many of them which are out there. So, yeah, it looks fun and they look great, but it's just very, very difficult to find a place where you could learn to fly them.
There's a small airport near – or close to where my mother lives on the eastern shore of Maryland that has auto gyros over there. I see them flying overhead all the time. I don't know if they're just giving rides or if they're giving lessons as well. I always thought someday I'd go over there and see what's up with the auto gyros.
Adam, any thoughts? Do you prefer your rotor powered or unpowered?
Yes, interesting. I'm not sure. Is one better than the other? I'm not sure. We've got quite a few auto gyros in the UK. Some of your listeners might have heard of a guy called Ken Wallace, who actually designed and made his own. He was a World War II RAF pilot, wing commander, and he was actually the guy who designed and built Little Nelly, which was the auto gyro that James Bond used in You Only Live Twice, I think was the film. And he did all the stunts as well. But some of his air show performances were absolutely amazing. I mean, you know, you could have thought it was a bit special the way it was being thrown around and the sky. So, yeah, we often have auto gyros coming over here, actually, over the house. And, they're always a bit intriguing, more intriguing to look at than a helicopter, I always think.
All right, let's move on to our mythology lesson for this week.
David made a site screw.
David messed up, right. We heard from Victor and a couple of others, actually. You might remember, I think, two episodes ago when we were talking about Boeing selling their
yacht
named Daedalus. And David commented about the irony of that for flying too close to the sun and, you know, having the wax melt. But Victor pointed out that it was Icarus who flew too close to the sun, but Icarus was Daedalus's son. Daedalus designed the idea,
the wings.
So in a sense, Daedalus is the inventor of flight, and it's just the pilot, the operator that messed up.
And like Boeing created a product that was faulty because if you flew close to the sun, it was fatal. So, okay, let me change my perspective on the boat. It's still a bad name for that boat.
Yeah, there is still an irony, I guess I should say, to that name. But so I looked up, or maybe Victor sent along, I don't recall, the link in Wikipedia. But Daedalus invented the labyrinth for King Minos of Crete. I didn't know that was the case. Yeah. And the king had Daedalus imprisoned inside the labyrinth. And that's where this plan came to fly out of there. That part of the mythology I hadn't, didn't know or couldn't recall. And then Richard sent in an item, Dobbins reservists tie the knot aboard a C-130. David, you might like this story. Two Air Force reservists from the 700th Airlift Squadron got married on the back of a C-130 Hercules.
Well, I am now single, so now I just need to find a woman that will do that with me. But no, I think this was really kind of cool. I mean, if you're gonna go, you might as well go all the way, you know. And but you have to find the spouse that loves the 130 as much as you do, you know, and then find someone who's willing to stand on the flight deck also and tell you you're married.
You know, in fact, she liked the idea. She said that the bride said, I think when he brought up the idea of us getting married in the back of the plane, he threw it out there as a joke. But she says, when I approved and was just as stoked about it as he was, we didn't want to do it anywhere else. So congratulations to the newlyweds.
And when I first saw the story, I thought this was conducted in flight. So just in case people want to know, this occurred on the ground for obvious reasons. You can't really charter a C-130, and you couldn't co-opt an existing flight. But they were very clever. They found a scheduled flight, and I believe they got married either at the very just before the flight departed or just after it got back. And the husband is a pilot on the aircraft, and his wife is a first lieutenant, is a navigator. So they're both obviously connected with the C-130. So perfect way to get hitched.
Yes.
All right, let's wrap this up, guys. I want to thank Adam Spink again. Adam, are you on social media someplace where folks can follow you? Or
yes, I'm on Twitter as at Adam Spink, and then on Instagram, Adam F. Spink.
Somebody, there was already an Adam Spink on Instagram.
Yes, I think that was there. Must have been.
I hate that when that happens. Yeah. Thanks again. Really appreciate you coming on the show. And
it was my pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Great to have you. Great to have you. We're at airplanegeeks.com. You can find show notes for this and every episode there. If you want to go straight to the show notes, of course, we have a shortcut for that, airplanegeeks.com/629. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So, David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter, Facebook. If you know, can spell what just flew by with spaces in between, you can find me on Instagram. And, of course, you can find me on our Slack listener team. And you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com to join the fun, and we'll send you a link.
Very good. And Max Trescott.
Oh, first, I want to wish a happy Thanksgiving to all of our listeners here in the United States. And I also know that over in the UK, they celebrate Thanksgiving by being grateful for all those crazy people who left their country 400 years ago. I'm sure it's a huge celebration over there.
Yeah.
But yes, you can find me at all the usual places, the best places to go to Aviation News Talk, the podcast you can find wherever you get podcasts, or go to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact at the top if you want to shoot me an email.
All right. And you can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Max Flight. Also with David at the UAVdigest.com talking
but
about.
But not this week. But not this week.
But not this week. That's right. Because we record Thursday evenings and that's Thanksgiving. So we won't. So we'll skip a week. Also, you can find me on the Airplane Geeks listener team, of course, that David mentioned. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.